pleasure being here at UVA. I drive by the law school at least twice a day, so I stop in every now and then to say a few words. I was here in the fall of 2006 when the Innocent Man was published, and we had a similar event like this. We talked about the book and innocence issues. We have lived in Charlottesville now for 15 years, so I guess it has become home. My son graduated from UVA in 2005. Last summer, I had the thrilling experience of taking a bartering course here. He finished law school at Ole Miss back in May of last year. Took the bartering course here, hated every moment of it. Took the Virginia Bar in Roanoke back in July, passed it, and is now in Washington knocking on the doors looking for jobs because there aren't many. But he's interning with the Public Defender Service in D.C. and spending a lot of time in the courtroom. So I'm very proud of the fact that when he decided to become a lawyer. He probably couldn't think of anything else to do. And couldn't find a job, so he decided to go to law school. In the course of law school, he really, really grew up, and that's what happens to a lot of us. It happened to me. He became a much more serious person. He's kind of a frat boy here at UVA. I'm sure not y'all went through that. But he had a good time as a KA, as Greg showed. really grew up in law school and became concerned about issues that he has always heard discussed in our home, issues dealing with social injustice and the rights of the less fortunate, things like that. And now to see him pursue a career along those lines is very gratifying if he can just get a real job with a real paycheck. I'm going to ramble a few minutes about innocence matters, maybe tell a few stories. And this is real informal. I didn't write anything down. There are no prepared remarks, which is not unusual. I just kind of wing it. But there are a lot of stories to tell. If you, we're going to have a lot of time. How much time do we have?
You can talk
as long as you want. Well, I'm not a big talker.
Okay? Yeah. Wine and
talking. Okay, well, something like that. We got plenty of time. At some point, I hope the conversation shifts from here to out there. You guys ask whatever's on your mind. If you really want to interrupt me, it will be easy to do. You'll see in a few minutes. But we'll open it up and talk about the issues that bring us here today. Now, we have how many interns in the program?
There's 12 students in the clinic, and then there's 100 volunteers.
And all the volunteers are law students?
Everybody.
Okay. And the interns are third year?
Both and.
Second year. Okay. There are about 45 innocence projects scattered around the country today. The number changes. The new one will start somewhere, and then the existing one will go out of business. They're all terribly underfunded. There's no government money. Because the system is not, it's not designed to do what we're doing. Nowhere in our constitution, our system of government, do we have any laws that deal with innocent people being convicted? Because it's not supposed to happen. So you can't get any government money. All innocence projects are funded privately, if they're funded at all. They get a few bucks from the local bar association, something like that. Most of the innocence projects are at law schools, like this. We started one at Ole Miss 2 years ago. There is a correlation between three things. The minority population, the amount of money spent on training law enforcement, and wrongful convictions. And in places like the Deep South, it's a recipe for disaster. And Mississippi, my home state, there's been almost no innocence activity in that state. And there are thousands of innocent people in the state prison. And we just started the project there. We've had three exonerations in the last 5 years. So we're trying to start innocence projects. We're trying to keep the innocence projects going. around the country. There's a loose affiliation, but no real organization. You know, you help each other out. The Innocence Project is in New York, founded by Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld. That's the famous one. And I'm on the board, and our budget each year is about $6 million, and we have to about raise all that from foundations and divisions. And it's a huge challenge. With that money, we kind of go coast to coast. We'll take a case anywhere. 2 or 3 years in Virginia, Borough, Washington, being one. Again, they're all DNA. All DNA, that's one of the requirements. Some Innocence Projects try to specialize in non-DNA cases, and those are brutal because there's no biological evidence. The DNA cases are almost impossible to win. We now have 245 of the Innocence Project. But non-DNA, you have to go back to the scene of the crime. And it could be 20 years ago. And we're working on two of those now at home, but no DNA to go back to the scene of the crime. You reinvestigate. And we're chasing down witnesses in Oklahoma now that I can't remember what they did last week, let alone the crime scene 25 years ago where everybody was drunk. And it's more zone sometimes you think is impossible. There's some great stories with Innocence Projects. One of my favorite stories comes out of New Orleans. IP&O is probably the most successful freestanding local Innocence Project in the country. They have 27 exonerees in a tough, tough jurisdiction, really tough juries. It was founded a few years ago by a lady who was the foreman of a jury in a capital case. And the jury heard the case and they retired. They found the person guilty and they were sufficiently upset they returned the death penalty for her. And a year or so later, she had realized that, as it came out during the appeals, that the police and prosecutors had withheld evidence. They had, in fact, convicted the wrong person. They convicted an innocent person, and he was still in prison. She became so infuriated by that that she sold her business, which was a trucking company, took all the money, and started the New Orleans Innocence Project. And today, Spiel is working diligently to free innocent people. In the past 3 years, since The Innocent Man was published in October 2006, I can keep that one straight. There's so many books now. They kind of all run together. I thought I was fairly prolific, like the dean said, until I read the New York Times Sunday Magazine this past week about James Patterson. He published 9 books this year. And he published 9 books last year. And he's probably said 51 bestsellers, and he just signed a new contract for 17 more books. I mean, I thought I was cranking them out. Of course, he has 5 collaborators, so he ain't really doing all the writing. It just seemed like way too much work. Yeah, I probably did. Last time I was here, I got sued. The lawsuit wasn't created here, but it damn sure didn't help what I said. We had a video, and we straightened off. We didn't do it. We're not doing it, so. I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Fine, just tell me. I'll watch what I say. But there was no video, and it was streamed up the internet, and then I got sued by some of the people I read about it, The Innocent Man, and they picked a clip. And I said, the first person who sues me is going to be the district attorney in Oklahoma, which was a stupid thing to say. But I'd said it before, just not where it'd be recorded. And sure enough, when he filed suit, and he was the first one to say, he attached that clip, the language, the transcript of what I said, and made a big deal out of it, and the judge even commented on it, and all that kind of stuff. So it made me squirm. It also made me realize, you just don't say what you're thinking the whole time. So, I got kind of nervous when I walked in here a while ago because it got played in court. But anyway, since the book is published, I'm trying to go to every Innocence Project in the country and raise money. On a good night, we raised $150,000 one night in Kansas City. We had a bad night in Atlanta, you know, a couple of years ago, and raised whatever we can get to pay part-time salaries, to pay investigators, to pay lawyers who will help out, to pay interns. And so I'm going around the country on this little tour I've got going. They want me to come to Alaska, which is really, I'm doing this, you know. I'm not charging for it, but that's a long way to go for one night. But I'm going to try to go to all of them. And as I go to them, I get to meet the exonerees. And almost every dinner function, whatever, every night, I'd say, but get your exonerees there. And because if they'll speak, they steal the show. If you can get these guys who served 15 years in prison for somebody else's crime, if you can get them to get up in front of the crowd, it really makes the evening. And oftentimes they'll do it. I've also met their families and their lawyers and their friends and a fair number of families of victims who get chewed up in the system too because they go through a wrongful conviction and maybe 15, 20 years or maybe never before the real killer is found because the cops were too busy chasing the wrong guy. But I talked to these exonerees after dinner, and you know, sometimes we'll sneak off and go to a bar or something. That's when the stories really start flowing. And I always ask them, tell me your story. You know, how did it go wrong? And stories are all fascinating. I mean, stories are unbelievable. I talked to a guy in Ohio, Gary Reese, who spent 25 years in prison for a crime that was never committed. There was no crime. There was an alleged rape by a lady who was, as it turned out, a self-mutilator, a really wacky person who the cops knew was a nut, but she cried rape, and when the police came to her apartment, she was covered in blood. And she pointed to this guy, Gary Reese, who lived in the apartment building. The cops were marching off in the wrong direction, and they convict Gary. 25 years. He got out, and the police, not long after he went to prison, the police began having serious doubts about their victim because she was such a nutcase. Even then, it took him 25 years before he was paroled, not pardoned. I met a young guy in St. Louis who could have been, you know, your fraternity brother, some great-looking, you know, young man, clean-cut, well-dressed, and he said, I served 7 years on death row in Missouri. And he just didn't look like a normal exonerate. These guys, most of them are pretty scarred and have a very rough time after they get out. He seemed to be very well put together. And I said, okay, how did you go to death row for 7 years? He said, well, it's a great story. His wife was having an affair with a detective. There was a murder down the street. The cop knew how to, you know, manipulate. So the wife harvested semen from her husband, gave it to her lover, who planted the evidence, switched it to trial. It's a DNA case. They got it. There's no way around it. And he goes to prison for 7 years. On death row, this guy's sentenced to die. Okay. And I said, well, I'll get out. He said, well, the detective found another girlfriend. And my ex-wife took offense and they filed for divorce. And she finally was consumed by guilt and came forward. The cop was never punished in New York. He retired, married the third or fourth time, moved off to Florida and retired. Which is, these people are never punished. The police wrongdoing in these cases is often hard to imagine. The prosecutorial misconduct is astonishing. And they are never punished. Because they control the system. They're not going to investigate each other. It's possible to sue them, it's very difficult. But there have been some nice settlements. But again, it's very difficult to get the pot. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the case of Marty Jenkins from New York. It's been pretty widely publicized. My current focus is wrongful confession. As you know, there are many reasons for wrongful convictions. Bad eyewitness identification is a huge problem. Junk science is a huge problem. Hair analysis and bite mark analysis and all these different, it's just junk. Okay, and there's no national certification for forensic experts. So that's a whole different issue. Snitch testimony, which is something that most countries have outlawed. But snitches are testifying today, somewhere. The false confessions of the 245 DNA exonerations through the Innocence Project in New York, at least 20% involve false confessions. And when a defendant confesses, when they roll the tape, and you show it to a jury, conviction is guaranteed 90% of the time. Because people cannot get over their belief that you would never confess to something you did. And so I'm fascinated with the issue of confessions and how they happen. And when you study them, it becomes very evident how they happen. Marty Jankoff was 16 or 17 years old, an only child, an affluent home in Long Island, long Long Island, I'm not sure which one, you know. Went to bed one night, woke up the next morning, found both of his parents in the den, stabbed, butchered, and dead. Except his mom was dead, his father was breathing his last. He called, 911. The rescue people came out and found this horrible crime scene. And the police, this is where the first mistake in the wrongful conviction. The police have a hunch, okay? And the hunch here was that since this was an affluent area, there was no crime. It had to be an inside job. And since Marty was the only one left, only child, at the scene, well, this poor boy is totally emotionally wasted and distraught. The lead detective says, I think that kid probably did. They took him straight down to the police station and put him in an interrogation room. He can't even think straight. And quickly accused him of a crime. And he can't believe it. And he says, he denied it, said, please, let me talk to my uncle. Can I have a friend in here? He was too young to think about water. At one point during the interrogation, the detective said, the phone call came in for the detective. So he goes out. He comes back and he says, that was the hospital. Your father's not dead. He's been revived. And he said that you did it. At that time, his father was dead. His father already died. And when the detective said that, Marty just completely fell off the pieces. And the cops started suggesting what might have happened. And then they always suggest, well, maybe you blacked out. Maybe you don't remember this. But there's some drugs involved. Maybe you don't recall because it was so horrible. Emotionally, all these tricks are going to play. And he finally gave them what they wanted, which was a confession. He served 17 years, from the age of 17 to the age of 34. Got a couple of years ago. And to the Innocence Project, through DNA. They know who the killers are. It's a bad business deal with his father, and they broke into the house at night. They may not ever catch him because 17 years in the fire. Marty is now in college and plans to go to law school, where he wants to be a criminal defense lawyer. So there are some good results, not very many. But again, most of these guys, once they get out, when they get past the euphoria of being out because they thought they were going to die in prison, reality hits hard. Most states still do not have compensation schedules or schemes for these people. My state, Mississippi, last year we passed one that gives the guys $50,000 per year that they live in prison, which is peanuts, but it's also a nice start. Without a doubt, I've over the years taken a lot of notes, and I've even talked to my publisher about taking my top 10 wrongful conviction stories just like these, and writing, not 500 pages, but maybe 40 or 50 pages about each one, and cover wrongful convictions and all the reasons for wrongful convictions, and this is my top 10. These are 10 stories you cannot believe. All current, all probably still happening. And there's a lot of interest in that. I just don't know all the work. The nonfiction is really difficult, and it's just too much work to dig through all these book piles like I did for The Innocent Man. My favorite wrongful conviction story, though, the steal, the winner, is the one from here in Virginia. The Norfolk Four. Did y'all study that or? Okay. All right. This is one that is still, it's not over. The crime happened in 1997. But it's the most, it's probably the worst case I've seen yet of police misconduct and prosecutorial malfeasance and negligence. And I've seen hundreds. The case started, and the story started in 1997. There was a man named Omar Ballard, who is in prison in Oklahoma and Virginia now, living for the rest of his life. Lucky he's not dead. Tough kid from the tough streets in Newark, New Jersey. His mother was a prostitute, a crack addict. His father was one of the customers who thought he left nothing behind. Omar's mother abandoned him when he was like 2 or 3 years old. He was in and out of foster homes. He naturally gravitated back to the streets from where he came. He, by his own testimony, this is his own story, he loved the street life. He loved the drugs, the sex, the violence, he loved robberies, gangs, shootings. He loved that life. And he got into trouble a few times. Things got a little too hot when he was 18 years old. And he left Newark and landed in Norfolk, Virginia, staying at the small apartment of a friend. His first known rape victim was not long after he got there. He attacked a woman, sexually assaulted her, and beat her with a baseball bat, but somebody ran him off before he could actually rape. He got away with that. The second one was the one that he actually killed Michelle Bosco. She was an 18-year-old wife of a sailor. This area of Norfolk is next to the base, and there are thousands of young sailors and their families down there in small apartments. And he had met the Boscos, they were from Pittsburgh. And one night, July 7, 1997, by his own admission, he was drunk, stoned, and looking for sex. And he went to their apartment. He knew their husband was at sea. He talked his way into the apartment. One thing led to another. She resisted, they fought, he choked her, he raped her, then he stabbed her 3 times in the heart with a steak knife and left her. And the next day her husband came home from the sea and found her body. And you can imagine the scene in the afternoon, it wasn't dark yet. And the neighbors came over, there was a big crowd. And the police were investigating the crime, the scene. They were there for 9 hours photographing the body. And the first mistake happened. The first mistake being the cop at the scene has a hunch. In this case, the detective was looking at the neighbors and talked to one of the neighbors and said, do you have any idea who may have done this? This is horrible. This is a vicious crime. Any idea who may have done this? And the neighbor said, yeah, that guy right over there, Dan Williams. He was a U.S. sailor, married. And so at that point, the cop said, yeah, I think he's kind of creepy. And that's how it all got started. The police, the detective went to Dan Williams, number one of the Norfolk Four, and said, would you come down to the police station and answer a few questions? And he said, sure. You know, he was upset because he knew the victim very well, and her husband. And he went to the police station. He had no criminal record. He had never been interrogated, and he was completely innocent. And innocent people are far more likely to easily waive their Miranda rights. They have nothing to hide, and he did that. And the cops know various tricks to get you to do that quickly without much thought. After a couple of hours of interrogation, he began to realize that the police suspected him, and it really threw him for a curve. He couldn't believe that he was a suspect in this murder. A couple of hours later, the police asked him if he would take a polygraph exam. People who are innocent are far more likely to say yes because they trust the cops and they have nothing to hide. It's a fatal mistake. He took a polygraph exam and he passed it. But as you know, the police can play dirty. This is one of their favorite tricks. The cop comes back to the interrogation room, throws a chart on the floor, language is terrible, and says, "You flunked it. We now know you're lying." Got in his face and started this for hours. "You're lying. You're lying. We're not going to take no for an answer. You're in that apartment. Why are you lying to us? We can prove you're lying. We've got the test results right here." And this goes on all night long. After 10 hours of interrogation, nonstop, no breaks, no food, no friends, nothing. After 10 hours, Dan Williams starts to crack up. He thinks, well, maybe I did black out. Maybe I did do something. Maybe I don't know. Maybe I was involved in this. After 12 hours, he was pretty much delusional. And after 13 hours, he started talking. He said, "Okay, I think I remember some of this now." The cops had fed him details of the crime, even showing the picture of the body, which is way out of bounds. And after 15 hours, Dan Williams confessed. He was charged with capital murder and put in jail in Norfolk. The police were happy they solved the crime. Good police work and taking care of, you know, it's a brutal murder. 6 months later, his DNA came back, and to everybody's surprise but Dan's, there was no match. He was cleared. In most jurisdictions, at that point, the police and prosecutors would say, "Okay, well, we probably have the wrong guy. You know, probably have the wrong man. Let's look around." Not in Norfolk. In Norfolk, they had a new theory. There were two rapists, two murders. And so they called in another sailor who lived nearby, and Joseph Dick, who was very shy and easily manipulated and not exceptionally bright. It took them 9 hours to overwhelm Joseph Dick. And when they used a polygraph, which Dick passed, they used the same trick on him, accusing him of lying. They told him that Dan Williams, number one, had implicated Dick in his confession, and he had not. So Dick gave him a confession that was completely inconsistent with Williams' confession. Method of entry, method of murder, who went first, who went that way. 2 months later, Dick's DNA came back, and he was cleared. So they were 0-2. Both men in prison, in jail, charged with capital murder. So the cops suddenly had a new theory. There were three members of the gang. They called Dick back in. Another 10 hours of interrogation, he gave him a name, the name of Eric Wilson, a sailor from Texas who was still on duty. They asked Eric to stop by just to answer a few harmless questions. 11 hours later, Eric confessed and gave a confession totally inconsistent with the first two. 2 months later, his DNA came back and he was cleared. The cops had a new theory. There were four members of the gang. The fourth name was Derek Tice. Derek Tice had been honorably discharged. None of these four had ever been arrested before. None, they'd never been interrogated before. They'd never, you know, been through this. The cops rounded up Derek Tice, brought him in, and told him that the other three had included him in their confessions, and that they were going to take a deal to get by with life and not death. But the cops promised Derek Tice that he would get the needle. They kept saying, "We're going to get the needle. We guarantee it. If you don't tell us what happened, you're going to get the needle, and we're going to be there to watch you." And they say this repeatedly, time and time, hours, nonstop. Same cop, by the way. A cop who had a bad history, of producing false confessions. Still in force. Tice confessed and implicated a fifth sailor. I can't get the name of it. Rick Pauley was number five. The cops picked up Rick Pauley, but he would not confess. Didn't matter. He was charged with capital murder and put in Norfolk jail. Number six was Jeffrey Ferris, who also did not confess. He was charged with capital murder and put in jail. And then 2 months later, numbers four, five, and six, their DNA came back, all clear. So they had six of them in jail, all cleared by DNA. So the cops have a new theory. There were seven members of the gang. They took out to find number seven, and he was a sailor from Little Deputy named John Dancer, who had been honorably discharged. Dancer had been a member of the military police, and he was not easily intimidated, and the interrogation did not go well at all. The cop almost got, you know, some of his own mess with Dancer. Didn't matter. Dancer didn't confess. There was no evidence against him. Just some third-party stuff that came from another confession. Dancer was charged with capital murder and put in prison. Meanwhile, Omar Ballard, 2 weeks after he killed Michelle Bosco, he followed a 14-year-old girl home from McDonald's, grabbed her, raped her, beat her, and got away. And then she happened to recognize him later. So he gets caught. He's in prison. He's been in prison for about a year since 1999 by this point. And Ballard, I did something that no one will ever know why, just because he wasn't in life. He wrote a letter to a friend in Norfolk in which he basically admitted to the murder of Michelle Bosco. He knew Michelle, he referred to her in the letter. This friend got the letter, took it to the police. They did not want to show it to the prosecutor, but they eventually did. Prosecutors did not want to show it to the defense lawyers, but the judge made it. So suddenly, you had an admission from the killer. They tested his DNA real quick, and they got a hit. The DNA at the crime scene, DNA on the bed, DNA in the side of the victim, the Jordan's skin under her fingernails, absolute match. Killer was Omar Ballard, and there was no other DNA. At that time, when they got the hit, they had seven U.S. sailors in jail, all charged with capital murder, all cleared by DNA evidence, none of whom had any kind of criminal record. At that point, most people would say, let's call time out here. You know, this thing has gotten taken care of. Not in Norfolk. They had a new theory. There were eight of them. Omar Ballard and the seven boys in prison, in jail, awaiting trial. And they took this new theory and ran with it. Okay? They went to see Omar Ballard in prison, the same cops. It was not a 15-hour interrogation. It was about 15 minutes. Ballard said, I did it. I did it all by myself. I was the only one there. I killed her with a serrated steak knife, the first person to identify the murder weapon. I went through her purse and took $35, the first time the cops had thought about robbing. He gave them more details from the crime scene than they even had themselves. He said, those boys didn't do it. And the chief lead detective said, we have four confessions. He said, I don't care how many. He said, those boys are stupid, okay? If they confess, I'm telling you, they didn't do it. I did it all by myself. I have a lot of remorse. She was a nice girl. That's, if Omar Ballard could be videoed today, he would say, I did it all by myself. Those four boys, seven boys, whatever, I never met them. Didn't know them, never saw them. And he still says it. Didn't stop the Norfolk authorities. They went to trial. Joe Digg pleaded guilty. Dan Williams and Joe Digg pleaded guilty right before the DNA hit on Omar Ballard. The judge refused them to allow them to withdraw their guilty pleas. Okay? So they went off to prison. Derek Tice went to trial, and he was found guilty of capital murder, since been reversed. He spent 12 years. Eric Wilson went to trial, and the jury convicted him of rape only. He spent 8 years in prison and was paroled, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. He was the first one to get out. As of last July, the first three were all in prison. And there was a huge clemency effort, a massive effort, driven by some big law firms who spent millions of hours investigating these cases. And a really strong clemency petition was made to Governor Warner as he left office. Governor King had it for 4 years on his desk, almost 4 years. They hired 31 or 32 retired FBI agents to individually examine the crime scene. And they did that. But these guys are, you know, tough cops. And all 31 or 32 came back and said, this is so obviously a crime scene involving only one assailant that you cannot possibly argue others were involved. There was only one killer here, okay? The evidence is clear. There were calls, three or four former state attorneys general in Virginia, I think three Democrats and a Republican, all lobbied Kane for pardons, complete pardons. And the movement grew and grew, and then it just stalled. We thought a year ago. I got involved in a case probably 3 years ago, just as sort of an observer and someone who was pretty close to the governor. And we talked about it, we swapped letters, and we thought at one point we were right on the goal line. We were going to get these four pardons, complete pardons, and you know, get these boys out of prison. Then something happened, and excuse me, it got stalled. Last summer, the pressure was cranked up when new Tim Kaine was leaving office this month, and there was a renewed effort to pressure him to do what was right. And fortunately, on August the 2nd of last year, he conditionally pardoned the three remaining boys from prison. Which means that they certainly are not exonerated or cleared. They're registered sex offenders. Every day, every year, Eric Wilson in the small, thank you, this, he lives in a small town in Texas. He has to go down on his birthday with his parents to the county courthouse to register as a sex offender. He'll have to invite this for the rest of the party. Joseph Dick went home to Baltimore. His father was dying of cancer, and he was living with his parents, and that their home is within, I don't know, 200 yards of a public school. So he was notified he couldn't live with his parents. These people have zero money. There's no place to go. Dan Williams went home to Michigan, and under the terms of Michigan parole, he's still wearing something around his leg or arm, or he can't leave the house until, I don't know, some restricted movement or whatever, so they can't find jobs for him. And we went back to the governor with as much enthusiasm or clouds we had left late last month, and nothing happened. Frankly, the boys were just so thrilled to be, I mean, they never felt the gap. They were serving life and no parole. And they were in jail for 12 years. And it's, again, the most egregious case of wrongful conviction that I've seen out of a lot of cases. Beyond that, I continue to work on a case in Oklahoma that's 25 years old. I wrote about it in The Innocent Man. It's the second murder I wrote about in The Innocent Man. To put a face on the suffering, you have no idea what it's like for these people. Prison's bad enough when you're a serial killer, you know, when you get what you deserve. Death row is awful. And I've seen several of them. I don't care where you go, they're all hard to describe. But when you're innocent and you've given up hope, it breaks your heart. When you're there sitting with them and crying with them and, you know, writing letters every month and trying to tell them that something good may happen yet from their case, when you know it's a long shot. I've written certainly 20 some odd books now, and most of the books, I got the better books, deal with an issue, whether it's something like homelessness in the street lawyer, or the death penalty in the chamber, or the insurance, tobacco litigation, runaway jury. And I tend to leave an issue once I get through with it. I rarely go back to a book. I rarely go back to an area that I've researched. I just, you know, I have too many other books I want to write. But the innocence issue is one that still will wake me up in the middle of the night. And what is so frustrating about the work is that it almost takes a miracle to get an innocent person. It's fairly easy to convict an innocent person. It's fairly easy. highest incarceration rate, you know, in the civil lines. No one knows how many are innocent. And we'll never know, because you have to do a case-by-case study. But there have been some studies, there have been some projections, and the numbers range from, you know, 2% to 5%. So I mean, the math is pretty easy. There are a lot of them there. The other frustrating thing about this work is when you break down a wrongful conviction, they're almost all avoidable. If we would do, if each state would pass a packet of model legislation that we push in every state, the Innocence Project will file in every state every year, here's our packet. And it such simple things as requiring the police to record, either by audio or video, the entire interrogation. They got the equipment because they eventually used it, but only for the last 20 minutes. You don't see the first 15 hours. You don't see what they really did. All you see is this confession by a young man who's having trouble speaking. And that's what the jury sees. And that's why they did it. Legislation regarding experts in forensic science. Try to get, you know, a lot of the junk out of the marketplace. Legislation making very simple changes in eyewitness identification. That's nothing but fairness. Legislation that would require the state to spend more money to guarantee a fair trial, because these trials are never fair. If we could pass half the legislation, we could cut out more than half of the wrongful convictions. And occasionally I'm asked by, you know, people, you know, why take an issue like this instead of being more concerned with the victims of crime? Well, I got a great answer for that. The case of Ronald Cotton out of North Carolina, convicted of rape, sent to prison for 11 years. They got the wrong guy. Eyewitness identification manipulated by the police. While he was in prison, the real rapist attacked, raped, and beat, very, very violent attacks. Several women. He was eventually caught, sent to prison, to the same prison as Ronald Cotton was. And they looked very similar to each other. Ronald Cotton was very, very smart. Noticed this guy, the new guy, and he kept thinking, I've seen him somewhere before. He realized it was a police sketch, which was a very good police sketch, from the convicted. And Cotton pursued it. He saw the crime from inside the prison. Finally got DNA testing and got out. Those are the tragic cases. When you send an innocent person, I tell my conservative friends all the time, when you send an innocent person to prison, you just increase crime.